Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. The massive $867 billion farm bill flamed out last week in the House. The Farm Bill establishes agricultural policy for the next 5 years. It's critical legislation for the farm economy. Now, this story has a lot of twists and turns, and we'll go into those details. But in essence, the bill was controversial because it made it harder for people to participate in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which you probably know as SNAP, or food stamps. SNAP recipients would either have to return to education or work for their food subsidies. Democrats didn't back the bill. Now, here's an additional twist. The House Freedom Caucus took advantage of the bill's vulnerability to try and force a vote on immigration. Nothing to do with the farm economy, but immigration. The bill failed. Got that? Okay. So, how can the GOP move forward? Will the GOP reach across the aisle to reach a deal? What is the future of the Farm Bill and the SNAP program? To look into these and other questions, I'm joined by Jessica Webster. She's with me in the studio here. She is staff attorney for the Legal Aid. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Philip Brasher is also with us. He's senior editor for AgriPulse, which covers food and the farm economy, and he joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. Welcome, Philip.
Yeah, great to be here.
Oh, I'm glad. Now, before I start tossing all kinds of questions to my guests, we want to hear from you. If you're a farmer or you're involved in the agricultural economy, what do you think of the failure of the House to pass a bill? Are you concerned? What would you like to see Congress do? Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. Online, it's talk at nprnews.org. Philip, I want to start with you. Okay, so the Farm Bill reauthorizes farm subsidies, rural development, environmental conservation programs, food stamps, and other nutrition assistance. I mean, this is a huge bill. So what comes next? I mean, this $867 billion fails in the House. So now what?
Well, I think what we expect at this point is the leadership is going to have to work with the House Freedom Caucus, those hardline conservatives that you referred to that brought down the bill on Friday because they wanted, because of this unrelated issue on immigration. Leadership has to work with them and figure out address their concerns so that they can get their votes. But what we expect at this point is if they get that addressed, that they bring the bill back in June to the floor. They could do so under what's called a closed rule, a new rule for floor debate that simply excludes any more amendments and just takes the bill that was voted on Friday and then brings it back for another vote. That's fairly easy to do, but they have to do something to address these, to make sure they have the votes for it, to pass it.
So just give us, I mean, we could go on for the whole hour, but just give us a brief history. I mean, the farm legislation used to be that classic example of bipartisanship. So you had the rural legislators and the urban legislatures got together. They pushed the farm bill through. You know, scholars talked about this all the time, and now it's just blown apart.
Yeah, that really started back in the 1970s when they made the food stamp, the old food stamp program, now SNAP, as a national program. It had been sort of a spotty state-to-state program back then. They put it together with the Farm Bill, and as you point out, that produced this rural-urban coalition that supported the Farm Bill every 5 to 6 years. There have been a couple of hiccups in that. One was in 1996 when then-Speaker Newt Gingrich forced through some changes in farm policy, trying to move phase out farm subsidies and also do welfare reform on a separate track. So there was that hiccup. And then 2002, 2008, those are both very bipartisan. And then in 2013, 5 years ago, the last time the farm bill failed on the House floor, it was over this issue of work requirements and increasing. There already are work requirements, but it was increasing the work requirements that were in the program. Democrats bolted from the bill, and it failed. Eventually passed the House and became law, but without those provisions.
Okay, so Jessica, SNAP and the work requirements.
Sure.
I mean, so there are already work requirements here. So what we're really talking about is increasing the work requirements. Is that right?
Right, expanding the work requirements broadly. So what this bill that went down on Friday did was creates a broad new work requirement for anyone under 60. And it's a requirement to prove that you're working enough hours or that you're eligible for an exemption. So the new people that it now pulls into the requirement would be working parents, older workers, some veterans, people with chronic health conditions, people with disabilities. So a whole new kind of group of folks who are now at risk of a pretty unforgiving penalty if they don't meet the requirements that are under the law.
So, you know, with legislation, the devil is always in the details, right? I mean, that's the cliche. So, you know, it seems work requirements seems reasonable. But then I was looking at some of the details, like every month you have to file a certain amount of paperwork. And if you don't file that paperwork, you're out of the program for you. I mean, explain this because.
Right. It seems so simple. It seems so straightforward. Everyone thinks this. Why can't we do this? And the reason is that government has a very poor track record of implementing these kinds of requirements. And it's not so simple as going online and clicking a box or making a phone call and pushing a button or sending an email. We have really old computer systems that are this is a paper-based system. So we're talking about millions of pieces of paper being mailed back and forth to prove that you're working enough hours or that you're eligible for an exemption. It's doctor's notes. It's notes from your employer about why you missed work, why you missed hours of work. And so this millions of pieces of paper shuffling back and forth and things get lost. And we don't have the capacity to implement what they're promising.
And part of this capacity to implement, again, I'm a big supporter. I mean, I've been on this program and talked about the importance of job training and that we need better job training programs. And as I understand, there was an increased requirement of job training. But there was a pushback from a number of states saying, well, you know, we don't have that capacity and you're not providing the funding.
That's right. I mean, I think if you look at the number in the aggregate for, investment in education and training is huge. But if you look at it on a per person amount, it's about $30 per person for training. And so think about what types of education and training can you do for $30 per person a month? I mean, you can't do on-the-job training, you can't do subsidized work, you can't do apprenticeship programs or really robust education and training programs.
So I want to just read it. So what is your experience with SNAP? You live in rural Minnesota. What do you think of the farm bill? I mean, what worries you? Give us a call at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828, and online at talk@mprnews.org, because we'd love to hear your experience and get your questions. Philip, this farm bill did not fail in isolation. Now, I know it went down because of the immigration vote, but this farm bill is also happening at a time when the North American Free Trade Agreement is being renegotiated and the farm economy is under some threat, depending on how things evolve with the fight between the administration and the Chinese government. And at the same time, in the background, agricultural producers, I mean, they've been dealing with a multi-year drop in crop prices. So to me, this seems like a recipe for a lot of trouble.
It is certainly. It's interesting. That's the argument that that the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, Mike Conaway, is using for passing this bill and for not cutting crop insurance or the subsidy programs anyway. Used that very vigorously last week. Now, it's important to remember a couple of things, is that the crop insurance program, which is the most important program, really, to producers and beyond just and soybeans.
And just to interrupt you, Philip, just interrupt you. Just give us a brief definition of the crop insurance program.
crop insurance is, again, it's the most important program if you listen to producers, and it's available for a wide range of commodities. Basically, it originally allowed you to insure your crops against storm damage, against hail, floods. It's been expanded over the last couple of decades very significantly in terms of it now covers revenue. So it's not just your yield, but it's the changes, fluctuations in price. So it's you're able to insure your revenue on your crop. So it's very, very important. It's permanently authorized. So it doesn't need, nothing happens if this farm bill expires.
Okay. So that's the key to the farm bill. Is that crop insurance?
That's it's probably the most important, but there are also various commodity subsidy programs as well. They carry through the current marketing year, which is very complicated, but for corn and soy, for your crops up there in Minnesota, that's through next summer. It's this year's crops, and they're covered for these commodity programs through next year.
Okay.
Through this crop.
All right. Now I want to go to the phones, and I believe Dee Dee from Anoka is on the line. Dee Dee?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. So what's your comment or question?
Well, I'm self-employed, and I'm on SNAP, and it's so important for our family. I had an experience with the child care benefits a few summers ago when I was looking for work and working outside the home. It was so burdensome to be able to have to report these self-employment, and I've got two W-2s. I worked six jobs. I lost my career job in the recession and never got one back, and I had two little kids and a deadbeat dad. I work my tail off.
What do you do? What are the six jobs?
Well, I work for the Forest Service. I work for a university. I'm a musician. I have my own professional business. I don't want to go into it too much because I, you know, kind of don't want to talk about myself too much on the air. But I work really, really hard, and I qualify for this, and it helps us get out of the hole. But if I have to go back to reporting both a mixture of W-2 and 1099. It was so confusing. I spent 5 hours a week. It wasn't worth it. And then in the end, they decided that I hadn't qualified and I owed them $3,000 and I had to fight it, and that took more time. And in the end, I won because, you know, there were just too many cooks in the kitchen. They could not figure out what they were supposed to do with a person who was self-employed.
Right.
It was a nightmare. And yet, you know, when you're self-employed, this country says you pulled yourself up by your bootstraps. You can't, you know, I'm creative. I've done it. And I don't deserve to have to spend hours and hours in a nightmare of paperwork.
I would agree. So I want Jessica going to turn to you first, but Philip, also, if you want to weigh in, but Jessica?
So Dee Dee's experience is not an anomaly. That is a very common experience across public benefits and programs because we don't have a modern system. Dee Dee can't use an app. She can't go online and click a box. It is all a paper-based system of verification and documentation. And even when you submit what you're supposed to submit, sometimes there's requests for more, things get lost. So it really is an administrative burden and a nightmare. And you're not just hearing that from people receiving food assistance. You're hearing that from the counties and from the state saying, hey, we can't do it. We simply cannot do it. And just to give you an example, Minnesota restored a work requirement to single adults without children in 2013. Within 1 year, more than 40,000 people lost their benefits. Only 6,000 single adults with kids in that working eligibility kind of corridor are still connected to the program. So what we saw after that happened is more vulnerable adults showing up at our food shelves, our homeless shelters, our clinics, the VA. And it's expensive and time-consuming to try to reconnect people who are eligible back to this really basic and fundamental benefit.
You know, Phil, stories like Dee Dee, these are the stories that I hear, and just what Jessica is saying. And it doesn't yet, this doesn't seem to be the conversation that's going on in Capitol Hill.
Oh, not really. Not at all. You know, there's Democrats are talking about issues like this and the a number of, we haven't talked about some of the others. We focused on work requirements. This bill also essentially lowers the income eligibility limits by doing away with something called broad-based categorical eligibility. There are many states, Minnesota's one, I believe there are over 40 that have used this to have higher income eligibility. At the same time, this bill also raises some asset limits, allows you to have a more valuable car and still qualify, allows you to have a savings account of up to $2,000. There's a number of moving parts in it, but there's been very little discussion on this. And I think part of the reason is the expectation is that virtually all of this is going to be thrown out after this bill gets over to the Senate, because the Senate is going to do a bipartisan bill. It's going to get at least 60 votes, or it needs to get at least 60 votes. And these expanded work requirements that we've talked about won't fly over there, and a number of these other provisions, some of these other provisions as well. And so there's sort of this, how much is this real, in the sense that it can't pass the Senate, and the Senate bill is going to be much closer to what becomes law if we actually get a bill done this year, which is another question.
Okay. Jessica?
I was just going to say this highly partisan conversation that's happening in the House, it is curious because there is more of a bipartisan movement in the Senate. And if you look to communities and states, I'm an advocate for hungry people and for low-income people, and I sit at tables with farmers and with agricultural professionals, and so there's more kind of there's a collaborative coalition among in states and in communities and in the Senate, and you don't see that going on in the House. And frankly, some of the this kind of group of folks in the Freedom Caucus, this doesn't go far enough. I mean, this removes food assistance for 2 million people, and they actually would like to see it go further. So it's a really difficult, really difficult political fight.
And we have an online question from Eric in Rochester, and I'm glad he asked these two questions. So his first question is, where do the subsidies go, and why is the food stamp program in the ag bill? So, Philip?
Well, they were put together back, the nutrition part, the food stamp program was put together with a farm bill back in the 1970s. I think it was seen as part as a way of bringing together Democrats and Republicans behind in a bipartisan fashion. And it has worked because the bill had something for urban lawmakers. Nutrition assistance was seen as benefiting agriculture, which is the producers of the food that are purchased with the food stamps. And that was that worked for decades. It's become a little more problematic now, obviously, because now conservative Republicans are insisting on these reforms in the food stamp program, and that has turned this into a partisan issue the last couple of farm bills. But that was the reasoning for it, and it is more or less, if you look back at the history, it has certainly worked to the benefit of both farmers and the anti-hunger community to have them tied together. Farmers don't believe are afraid there's not the support, urban support for farm programs standing on their own.
Right. So, Jessica, just how effective is SNAP?
It's the most effective anti-poverty program we have in this country. It's tested. It works. It puts food on the table. It is the most effective program we have.
So let's go back to the phones and Tim in Crookston. Tim?
Yeah, good morning.
Good
morning. I'd like to chime in on the additional SNAP requirements. I mean, it might be a good idea, but visiting with Colin Peterson, the former ranking chair of the House Ag Committee on the minority side, he's been up here several times and talking with us farmers, and he's telling us that the Republican bill is requiring these additional work requirements, but he said all the town hall meetings had and visiting with all the agencies that would have to administer they're not set up to handle any additional training or any additional jobs. Not even to speak to some of the issues of, you know, getting people to jobs or training that don't have transportation. So, like he's saying, they're pushing it into the system, but they're not giving any solution to the system to how to handle this extra training and jobs. So yeah, well, that's just what I wanted to add there.
Yeah, and you're a farmer up in Crookston?
Yes, I am.
What do you farm?
I farm soybeans and wheat.
And how's it looking?
Well, it's looking very good after a very late spring, but we're getting caught up, and optimism abounds.
Isn't that the nature of farmers?
Isn't that the truth, though? Even though prices are down this morning, it looks good.
Okay, well, that's good. Now, well, I'm really glad that you called in. And, you know, one of the things, Jessica, that I find frustrating, you know, work requirements, it can sound really good. And, you know, that we want to get people, you know, attached to a job and pull themselves up. But it's this sort of, you know, the practicality of it. How are you going to go about doing it? This is what Tim has just called in, that he's heard from our representative, Colin Peterson.
Right. And I want to push back a little bit on, I mean, I think the way that we've talked this morning is about getting people back to work. Right. And most people are working.
Right.
I mean,
and
if you look at the data, we have robust labor market participation in Minnesota and nationwide. And so most people accessing SNAP are working. So let's look at the folks who maybe aren't working. You've got people between jobs. You've got folks who are working low wage work who may be losing hours or aren't getting enough hours because of unpredictable scheduling and lack of childcare. You've got older workers who are facing age discrimination and chronic health problems. You've got a number of folks actually who would like to be in the labor market, but perhaps aren't able to be hired or aren't being hired because of contacts with the criminal justice system or recent incarceration or a job gap history due to chemical dependency treatment. There are some workers that could be hired in this kind of job shortage crisis, but this concept or this narrative that people aren't working and they're accessing SNAP, I mean, it's not true.
Right. And how much of, when we're thinking about poverty and underemployment, I mean, how much does that become a big rural issue?
It's a huge issue. I mean, we have in Minnesota more than 27 counties that have high unemployment rates that have trouble meeting the current SNAP work requirement for single adults. So it's real.
Yep. Philip, on the farm bill, and let's say the one that you imagine is going to come out of the Senate, you know, whenever you hear about the farm bill, it's always discussed in terms of preserving the small family farm. Now, how much of this farm bill really helps out the small family farm?
Well, there are a number of programs, some of them which are set to expire and don't have any funding after September 30th. And that actually doesn't get talked about enough. That's probably the biggest risk of not passing a farm bill. There are actually three dozen. There are probably a couple of dozen that are really important. And there are all sorts of, there's some nutrition, there's some programs that are targeted toward organic, toward small scale producers in particular. They all expire and they all don't have any funding after September 30th. So they're really, really up in the air. The major part of our food is produced by larger farms, the vast majority of our food, I should
say.
And that's who the farm bill's main commodity. They're not limited to that, but that's, if you look at where the payments go, that's where they go. Those larger operations that you see in across Minnesota, western Minnesota, southern Minnesota, Iowa, and they're even in many cases larger in the South, which is where we get some regional differences. There's some issues over the payment limitations and the House bill would actually loosen those payment limitations that are in the existing law. The Senate is not likely to do that. In fact, there's probably going to be a battle over tightening what is actually in existing law, if not in the committee on the Senate floor.
So, Jessica, what would you like to see happen when it comes to SNAP?
I think retaining state flexibility is probably the most important thing we can do.
And what does that mean, state flexibility?
So that means that Minnesota can look at our population and our unemployment rates and our employment rates and where the jobs are, and can look at our population of seniors and people with disabilities and people who are sick, and can make decisions for our state on SNAP access and what it looks like. So what kinds of things and what we can do in Minnesota to make sure that everyone who's eligible can access the program, and not introduce these new kind of paperwork, paper pushing requirements that aren't meaningful to people. So that's what I would like to see. And I mean, if we had more investment in education and training, make it real, make it, apprenticeships and subsidized work and connecting people with stronger and robust education and training opportunities.
And Philip, do you see any chance of a new coalition or a revived coalition in order that the Farm Bill doesn't become hostage every 5 years?
I think it's way too early to say, and here's why I'm saying that. It just depends on a couple of trends that are happening. The House is becoming more urban. After every census, there are fewer and fewer rural districts, and so you're going to have a more urbanized House, and this is a long term concern to the farm organizations. But it's going to depend on who is in the control of the House in 5 years. The Democrats are obviously going to expand the nutrition, use the Farm Bill to expand nutrition programs in some ways. That's happened before. It happened in 2002 and to some extent to 2008 when there was money available to do that. So it depends very much on who is in charge of the House. Now in the Senate, the politics haven't changed much, and I don't think they will change that much, simply because every state, whether it's North Dakota or California, has two senators, and the politics are easier to see long term, and are less likely to change. The House is going to depend on who's in control. It's most likely going to be a bit more urban, though.
Right. And then, Jessica, when you're so one of the things that comes out of this whole debate right now is it designed for people to lower the rolls of people who are on SNAP? I mean, listening to you and listening to Philip in the conversation, that if this, let's say the House bill was revived in a closed vote, goes to Senate, it's not going to happen, but the Senate said, okay, lots of people would drop off.
Yeah, it is structurally designed to remove 2 million people nationally from SNAP assistance. And in Minnesota, tens of thousands of people would be removed. And the reason for that is, one, you heard Philip talk about a lower income limit. So people that are just over the eligibility guideline right now can still access SNAP. That would go away. And these asset limits, that would drop more people. And then these work requirements, even though many people are working, they're going to have to prove it. And they're going to have to prove it in this burdensome way, and this way that we know, the history shows, that people drop off because it's hard to get through this paperwork kind of circus.
All right. So let's go to Chris. You're in Hoyt Lakes. Is that right?
Yes. Question I have, and I got in late, is, what restrictions on what can you purchase with the SNAP money? Are there certain groceries you can buy and certain ones you can't? I guess that's my question. Thanks.
Yeah, so Jessica from Minnesota?
You can purchase food and groceries in a grocery store. You cannot purchase hot meals or prepared foods.
Okay.
And you can also now, we have a program where you can purchase food at a farmer's market, so fruits and vegetables, with your SNAP benefit.
Is that a new benefit?
It's called Market Bucks, and it just went statewide a few years ago. It's a pretty popular program.
And what about nationally, Philip, in terms of what can SNAP be used for?
It's the same thing. There are, interestingly, one of the things that's got zero attention is that there are a couple of programs. There's one that's already existing and another one in this bill to try to provide funding for new incentives to encourage fruit and vegetables, and in the House bill also dairy products with SNAP, some additional
some additional matching benefits if a retailer wants to offer incentives for fruits and vegetables and dairy. That's something that's in the House bill. And I think there'll definitely be some, probably be some support for that in the Senate as well. I wouldn't be surprised to see that come in the final law. What there is not, there is a debate, but it has not gotten anywhere so far over restricting or banning the use of benefits for SNAP benefits for sugary soda.
Right.
There was an amendment to do that in the House, but it was not allowed to be debated.
Hmm. Well, I like this idea of positive incentives for fruit and vegetables. I mean, that
well,
sounds
certainly
good.
There's research suggesting that it works too.
So, Philip, what are you watching now with the bill? I mean, so it failed for reasons that has nothing to do with the Farm Bill itself. Well, to a large extent, nothing to do with the Farm Bill itself, but it was really an immigration vote. So now what are you watching? So people who are following this, what are sort of the key, I don't know if they're landmarks or minefields to be watching?
Well, the next, I think a lot of focus is going to be on the Senate. So the Senate Agriculture Committee, the chairman and the ranking Democrat over there have been negotiating back and forth. They're not quite finished. The chairman would like to bring out the bill and have his committee act on it early in June. What it appears that we're now on a track where both the Senate committee and the Senate and the House could wind up acting on the Farm Bill in June ahead of the July the 4th recess.
And then is September 30th the critical date for that the Senate needs to be acting before September 30th?
No, it's not going to happen. I mean, they're going to talk about it. You're going to hear them saying we got to do this before September 30th. The critical date is actually the end of the year. And that's because there is a permanent law that is left in place strictly to keep to make sure Congress does something on farm continuous farm programs. The main effect of it is it would sharply increase the price of milk very sharply. I don't know if you remember a few years ago we had this. People talked about the dairy cliff when the the farm bill had expired. That's it. We'll have that again. And don't be surprised if we don't have that again at the end of December, because Congress will have to do something. If they don't get a farm bill by December after the election and that lame duck session, they will have to do an extension of the current programs, possibly through next year.
So the theory is nobody likes to pay more for milk.
Well, it would be terribly disruptive. I mean, we're talking about a huge increase in the price of milk because of this old antiquated law. That's the whole point. It's so be so draconian that Congress has to do something. And the farm organizations have been able to keep that in permanent, keep that in the law, because if it went away, Congress could very easily just allow all these programs to expire without any negative consequences.
And Jessica, this whole debate that's going in Washington, impact on Minnesota. I mean, as now this goes to the Senate or whatever the House is going to do, I mean, try and take it up, but it eventually goes to the Senate. Impact here on Minnesota.
We take it seriously. I mean, there's 621,000 people that purchased groceries with SNAP in Minnesota in 2017. So it's a critical part of our economy, and it's critical to thousands of families in Minnesota. We're going to watch it very carefully. And I think that some of the conversations that we're seeing in the Farm Bill are conversations that we had in our state legislature this year. So even if
that's
this
what
it, is
yeah,
something
I thought
that
was, yeah,
even
was
if this is something that goes away in the Farm Bill, we may be talking about it next session as we did this session. So we need to do more education about who accesses SNAP and what it looks like, and people are working, and that this is just a really critical program. I mean, I think also important to know that 70% of the people in Minnesota accessing SNAP are kids, seniors, and people with disabilities. So really vulnerable folks.
And also this notion of keeping, I mean, I think that there is an assumption that if you're on SNAP, you're not working.
Correct.
I mean, that seems to be the big, disjuncture in this conversation.
Absolutely. And it's folks are not only working, many folks are like the caller, Didi, earlier, Didi, yeah. working multiple jobs and just not quite making ends meet.
And so do you see the legislature, our local legislature, doing anything addressing SNAP in the coming sessions?
I don't know. TBD, I guess.
TBD?
Yeah.
And what will you be pushing for?
We're always looking for ways to make the processes less burdensome and to make sure that people who are eligible are enrolled. And I think what you talked about earlier, this concept of being able to purchase fruits and vegetables at farmers markets, we've looked to expand that. I mean, we have food deserts statewide where right. people don't have access anymore to a full service grocery, or they're shopping in a corner store, and access to the farmers market has been really fantastic for families and seniors.
And just very quickly, Philip, nationally, does this farmers market, does that resonate in terms of thinking about the farm program? I mean, we always think about the big producers, but what about the farmers market?
There's certainly been a lot of support for that. I can in the Senate, also in the House, it's certainly grown in attention. I think bipartisan support,
wow.
not particularly a partisan issue.
Well, thank you very much.
And I think we'll. Okay.
All right, thank you very much. Philip Rescher is senior editor for AgriPulse, and Jessica Webster, staff attorney for Legal Aid.
Thank you.